The Medrash takes us back a few hundred years. And the Medrash says, who is this tribe of Menashe? Menashe is the son of Yosef. The Medrash reminds us that when the 10 brothers came down to Egypt, Yosef told them, you're spies. And they said, no, we aren't. We're 12 sons of a father. One is missing. We're down to 11. The little one's at home with our father. We came here to bring bread, food home. And Yosef said, no, you're spies. I don't believe you. You must bring down your little brother. And they go back home. And Yaakov asked them, what did the guy say? And they said, he claims we're spies. And he said, why'd you tell me you have a little brother? And they said, what do you mean? He was able to tell us how our bunk beds were set up. He knew everything about us. We don't know where this guy knew all our private information. He used to know. He knew all the private names we called one another. Everything he knew. He knew to tell us all the things from our youth. We didn't think we could hide anything from him. And then he asked us, do we have a brother? So we said, yeah. Did we know that he'd say you have to bring him down? So Yaakov says, I'm not willing to let my son go down with you. And the brothers say, well, if you don't give us Binyamin, then we're not going back, because he said we shouldn't show up without the little brother. And when finally the food runs out, Yaakov, with great sorrow, tells the sons, go bring us food. And they say, we're not going without Binyamin. And then Yaakov finally consents. He says, look, guys, I don't know what you guys are up to. I send one son out to you, Yosef, he disappears. I send you down again, and then the next one in line, we know Reuven lost his right to the firstborn. Huh? We didn't order. Oh, thank you. And the second son, Shimon, suddenly disappears. Now you want Binyamin, he's the only one left for my wife, Rachel. May God protect him, but Yaakov is very worried. They come down to Egypt, Yosef takes them in, they have a feast. They leave, and Yosef tells his servant, take my silver goblet, put it in the sack of Binyamin, and then send them off with their sacks filled with food. They start traveling with their sacks filled with food, and Yosef tells the one in charge of his home, which was his son Menashe, he tells Menashe, go chase after them and tell them, why did you do bad in return for good? My master, he uses that goblet for doing all his sorcery, and you took it. Didn't you know that a man like him would figure it out? And Menashe climbs on his horse and he takes the men, and they give chase and they catch up to the brothers, and they show up, and the brothers say, what do you want? And he says, why'd you do such a bad thing to us? We treated you so nicely. Why'd you steal our master's goblet? And they say, no, we didn't. Whoever stole the goblet will be put to death. We don't steal. We didn't do that. And they say, okay, so let's check. And they start checking from the eldest. They check from Reuven. They go all the way down and they hit Binyamin's sack. They open it up and there's the goblet. And the brothers turn to Binyamin and they say, you thief, the son of a thief. Your mother was a thief, and you're a thief just like your mother. Now what are we going to tell our father? And the brothers all tear their clothing and start crying. What are they going to do? And they tell their father. And God in heaven saw the sorrow of the brothers, and God said, who caused them to tear their clothing in sorrow? Menashe. Payback for that will be that his offsprings will be torn in two. And that's why Menashe's tribe was cut in half. Menashe didn't, according to this Midrash, Menashe didn't say, I want to go live on the eastern side of the Jordan. It was a decree. Where the decree emanated from, so the Midrash says, in heaven it was payback for what Menashe did here, that he caused the brothers to tear their clothing.
But he also told them to.
Okay. We don't have to do everything our parents tell us. Sometimes
I'll cut that part off.
Of course, if our parents are following the Torah, then we're supposed to listen to them. But if they tell us something that's problematic, we see that in heavens they held that he went too far in this. So now we have the tribe of Reuven and Gad, half of Menashe. They're all going to remain on the eastern side of the Jordan. And the rest of us are going to inherit inside the land, but they're going to join us for conquering the land of Israel. It's interesting that Moshe tells them, the way you have to make calculation in life is firstly the chinuch of your children. And this is something that people sometimes overlook. Very often people look for parnasa, where they decide where they're going to live based on parnasa. And in Judaism, we all usually stress that a person has to look at the chinuch. How am I going to bring up my kids? That's the key. We have one of the major problems that faced Jewry in the United States in the last half a century is that many Jews went after their parnasa, and they went to areas where they didn't have a shul nearby, and they didn't have a good education system nearby. And even though they themselves had kept the Torah, well, if you don't have a shul nearby, where's your kid going to go to shul? Where are you going to go to shul on Shabbos? And that's one of the reasons why many of the Jews throughout, if you look at Long Island, or once the Jews moved out of the Lower East Side and Brooklyn, once the Jews made money and went out to places where it was more profitable and more pleasant to live, but they didn't have good education nearby and they didn't have good shuls nearby, so then the next generation lost it. You can't send your kid to public school and expect them to come back with Jewish values. It doesn't work. So some people didn't have a choice. But a lot of people did it because financially it was worthwhile. And that's what Moshe is telling the tribe of Reuven and Gad. You don't do that. Education comes before the question of parnasa. You have to make a parnasa. That's important. But you have to weigh the question of education no less, and to an extent even more than the question of parnasa. And we find that when the Jews were going down to Egypt, Yaakov wasn't concerned where we're going to make a living from. He didn't say, oh, I have to send out my men and figure out how we're going to make parnasa. No, that wasn't his concern. He was going down for reasons of parnasa. But he figured that's going to work out. But Chinuch, he said, before we get there, we have to make sure we have a yeshiva. He sends Yehuda in advance. They set up a yeshiva so that when they get down there, they could continue educating the kids the way they had educated them in the land of Israel. Moshe tells the tribe of Reuben and Gad, he tells them, when we finish conquering the land of Israel, and it's going to be divided the way it should, then you'll come back to your inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan, v'yitem nikiyim me'ashem u'mi'israel, and then you'll come clean of God and Israel. And this verse is the source of a halacha that we all know, the halacha of Narisayin. We know that I can't stand here and have a dip from McDonald's that has pork in it, and I stick my left finger into the dip and I put my right finger into the mouth. Right, I put my index finger in the dip and my middle finger in my mouth. So we know that Rabbi Meir once had to save his life. He was being chased by the Romans, so he did that. The Romans said they were trying to catch Rabbi Meir, so he ran into a non-kosher store. He dipped one finger into the non-kosher dip, and he put the other finger in his mouth, and then they said, ah, that's not Rabbi Meir. He'd never eat non-kosher. So, okay, sometimes you have to do it. But halachically, when one does it, that's the prohibition of Marisayin. We're not allowed to do something that even looks bad. And the Mishnah says that
When it's for rescue life, it's Pikuach Nefesh, right?
The Mishnah says that they used to have boxes filled with the donations in the temple, with the silver coins that the people donated. And when the person had to go in to take the coins out to purchase the animals for the Mizbeach, he couldn't go in with shoes, he couldn't go in with his tefillin, he couldn't go in with his kamea, the special locket that they used to wear that was supposed to protect them. He had to come in with one clean vessel, so that people shouldn't look at him and say, if he gets wealthy, they'll say, you know how he got wealthy? He took money from the funds of the Beis HaMikdash. If he gets poor, people are going to say, you know why he got poor? Because he stole from the funds of the Beis HaMikdash. So Chazal said, whatever is going to happen to him because he has access to the money, people are going to say it's because he did something improper with the money. So he has to ensure that no one could say anything bad about him. He could only go in with a garment that's clean, no pockets, no, everything's clean. You know that he didn't steal anything.
What happened to judging him favorably?
So you see that even though everyone's responsible to judge us favorably, we have to assume that people think the way people think. That's the basis of this concept of Marisayim. Now, the Mishnah says two things. That Moshe told the tribe of Reuben and God, then you will come clean of God in Israel. And this teaches us that we have to come clean not only of God. It's not enough that God knows that we're okay. It has to be that everyone who looks at us also realizes that we're okay. And then the Mishnah adds a second level. And that second level is, Umtzachin v'sechel tov v'enei Elokim v'adam. Find favor and wisdom in the eyes of God and mankind. The person has to be careful that what he does finds favor in the eyes of people. Sometimes we think, you know, I'll go into Burger King, and if someone asks me, what am I doing at Burger King? I'll tell them, I'm just buying a Coke. You're standing in line at Burger King. What are you standing in line for? I'm just buying a Coke. So sometimes we think, I could come clean of God in Israel. If Israel sees me enter the store, I'll give them the answer. So that's why the Mishnah adds the second level. No, we have to find favor in the eyes of people. We have to be careful that what we're doing finds favor in their eyes. Not to say that I'll enter a situation and then I'll be able to answer up and tell everyone that what I did was actually right. another application of this verse, finding favor in the eyes of mankind, the Netziv's nephew, the one who wrote the Torah Tmimah, Rav Baruch Epstein, once had a letter ready to be sent out by mail, and his uncle came in and he saw that the stamp was upside down. So he asked him, what's the deal with the stamp? So Rav Baruch Epstein said, well, when I put it on, I didn't realize that the envelope was upside down, so I put the stamp thinking it was right side up. And then afterwards I realized that the envelope was upside down, so the stamp's upside down, so I didn't want to take the time to put it under the steam, to take off the stamp, to put it back on. What's the big deal? The mailman will laugh at me. What do I care? So the mailman will laugh at me, okay. So the Netziv told him, no. This verse, find favor and wisdom in the eyes of God and mankind, even refers to a situation like this. Don't do something that, even if it's only the mailman that will laugh at you, you should also find favor in his eyes as well.
But if it's a guiding principle and you're not really yourself, you're making what everybody else thinks.
I think it has to be balanced. Meaning, we're not supposed to... It's like everything else. It's a question of balance. I don't know.
So tell me, you had brought an example, you know, that you shouldn't put in a situation that people would look at you in a negative way. For example, you had brought an example some time ago about if you are late, you don't pray for a certain reason. You shouldn't go to the Bet Midrash to pray there because people might look at you in a negative sense.
I don't remember saying the example. Okay.
This is.
I don't remember. Okay.
It's to be a difficult thing to swallow.
Why? I think that if it's taken too far, then a person starts feeling I'm not living my own life.
Well, since people would look at you in a negative way, you have to be that careful not to.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a situation. Right?
No one wants to have that as the deciding reason for why he's going to do something, but it does play a role. They say that the Chafetz Chaim once walked into shul late. And at the end of davening, he knocked on the bima, and he told the people what had happened, that there was a case of pikuach nefesh or something, that was why he was late to shul. So if we're like the Chafetz Chaim, that we're never late... So then, and we're on level of Chafetz Chaim, that if
that
someone
cares, like,
right, that that someone looks at us and the whole crowd says, oh, the Chafetz Chaim came late, so they, it makes them think that coming late is okay, so then maybe we could also knock on the bima. But you understand, you can only do this if you're only late that once. If you come late the next day, you can't really do that again.
Sorry, I'm late again.
I don't know if this story is true. They say the story. I don't know if it's true. Moshe is making all these conditions with them. All the deals, the details of conditions that you say, if you will, what will happen, and if you won't, what will happen, and you say the condition before you say the outcome, all the details of the condition. And they tell him, we'll do whatever God says. They told Moshe, look, we know you're speaking the word of God. Whatever God says, we'll do. And you don't need all these conditions. Whatever God says, we'll do. But you notice that Moshe didn't feel that sufficed. Moshe had the leaders there. And we have to know this when we make deals with people. Every time you're coming to sign a contract, so people are very sweet. Everyone's very nice. You want to rent an apartment, you ask the guy, are you going to fix this tree? He says, yeah. You ask the guy, are you going to fix this socket? He says, yeah. Everything he says, yeah. And then 2 days later, after you've signed the contract and you've given him the post-dated checks, you come to him and say, what about fixing all this? He says, oh, no, this one we didn't discuss. No, we didn't discuss this. There are always misunderstandings. That's why we're supposed to have contracts. Everyone's always sweet before you sign and before you give over the money. And Moshe Rabbeinu saw the same thing. Moshe said, guys, this is the deal. And he gave him all the details. If you do it, this is what will happen. And if you don't do it, this is what will happen. Moshe spelled it all out to them. And we're supposed to learn from that. We have to be careful. Spell it out. You never lose by spelling something out. When we don't spell something out, then we lose. Moshe gave, it says he gave the Gilad to Machir ben Menashe. And the problem is that Machir, the son of Menashe, must have died a long time earlier. I mean, 400 years have passed since he's been around. So it could be he lived a very long life, that could be. Or it could be that his whole family was named after him. He was a very important individual. So just like we call the tribes, we say he gave it to Dan, and it doesn't mean literally Dan, it means the family of Dan. So too, Machir's family was called Dan. The Pasuk discusses that Yair ben Menashe took a portion of the land on the eastern side of the Jordan. What's interesting is that Yair was not the son of Menashe. Yair was the son of the Chetron, who was the son of Peretz, who was the son of Yehuda. Yair was from the tribe of Yehuda. We see that in Divrei Hayamim. He was the grandson of Menashe from his mother's side. But the Pasuk attributes him to Menashe because he took part of the land with the tribe of Menashe. But really, he wasn't from the tribe of Menashe. He was a great warrior together with his sons. They took over much of the eastern side of the Jordan. Novach was probably his son. And this brings us to the end of Parshas Matos. So now we'll quickly run through Parshas Maaseh, and in 5 minutes we'll have to go on to Shmona Prakim. The Torah records our traveling throughout the deserts, the different places that we traveled. And Medrash refers to it like a father who's recounting with the son, look, over here you felt that, over here this happened, over here that happened. God is revealing with us how much He's done with us, where He's taken us. In our travelings to the land of Israel. Yesterday we discussed the more Nebuchim's understanding as to why all the Masot are recounted. We're warned to conquer the land and take over all of the land, and that if we don't, then those that will remain will be a constant thorn in our side. And we're given the boundaries of the land of Israel. There's a great discussion here what the boundaries exactly are, because the boundaries are described in a few places, and in each place they're described differently. So the question is, what are the legal boundaries? What application do these boundaries have halachically? We have the recounting of the Nesiim, that were the new Nesiim when we entered the land of Israel. And then we have the commandment of giving the Levim their cities and the outskirts of the city, how much they get. And we have the mitzvah of taking off Arei Miklat. Now God said, you have 3 Arei Miklat on the eastern side of the Jordan and 3 inside the land of Israel. And until all 6 were set up, none took effect. And Moshe was quick to take the 3 on the eastern side of the Jordan and set them up. And here we have the verse that says in Mishlei Chacham Levi Kach Mitzvot, the wise person grabs mitzvot. When the Jews are leaving Egypt, so everyone's looking to get wealthy. And Moshe's running to find Yosef's casket. He's interested in mitzvos. Over here too, Moshe said, if I could begin a mitzvah, I will begin it. Ultimately, ena mitzvah nikret el al shem mishe gumra. We attribute the mitzvah to whoever finishes the mitzvah. Moshe couldn't finish the mitzvah. Yeshua, his disciple, finished the mitzvah. So it's recorded as though Yeshua did the mitzvah. But Moshe said, whatever I could do, I will do. And that's the attitude we're supposed to have. Whenever we can perform even a partial mitzvah, whatever we can do, we should do. A person can't say, well, I won't be able to do all of it. Yeah. The general approach is, even if you can't do all of it, we're never going to be able to finish all of it. A person can say, I won't start learning Shas because I don't think I'll ever finish it. We don't work that way. We say, hopefully you will finish it. And anyways, we can't approach life with the attitude, when can I finish it? We have to try and do as much as we can. It's a similar concept. Yeah. The Torah tells us that when the Kohen Gadol passes away, so then the person who killed by mistake can leave the Ir Miklat. And the question is, why? What does he have to do with the Kohen Gadol? So the Gemara tells us that the Kohen Gadol should have davened. That a Kohen Gadol is responsible to daven and ensure that the state of the people is on a high level. And if he prays for them, so then they won't come to doing to having these mistakes of one person mistakenly killing someone else. The Rambam gives us another understanding in this. The Rambam says that we know that when a Chacham passes away, when the head of the people passes away, everyone has to mourn for him. The Halacha says, Nasi Shemet, if a Nasi passes away, Akol Krovav, everyone's supposed to be like his relative. Even the Kohanim become Tameh for him. Everyone has to take care of his burial. We're all considered his relatives, he's representative of all of us, and we're all supposed to feel close to him. So until the Kohen Gadol passed away, this guy whose relative was killed by mistake, he's thinking, the Goel Adam, he's thinking, when will I finally be able to avenge my relative's blood? He's constantly, inside of him there is constant inner bitterness, he's waiting to avenge the death. But the Rambam says that when the Kohen Gadol passed away, that would shake up the people so much that the person would forget the bitterness over his own relative, and that the bitterness of the Kohen Gadol's passing would overcome that bitterness, and this way he would be able to forgive this person who killed his relative, and he wouldn't kill him. I don't understand this Rambam. I don't begin to understand how we can feel that close to the head of the generation, that his passing is going to overpower a relative's passing, a relative's murder. But I guess that's a reflection of the level I'm on. The Rambam says that people are supposed to be on a level where it will overpower it. The Parsha ends, and Sefer Bamidbar ends with Shiduchim, with the daughters of Tzlafchad, that they come forward and they say, the tribes say, we don't want them to marry into other tribes, because then when their husbands will inherit them, their portion of the land will go over to another tribe. And God says, okay, they should marry within their tribe, and then they get married. So here there's a vort that people say, and I think there's a lot of truth to this vort. 40 years these girls spent in the desert. They're all tzaddikim. Machla, Tirza, Chagla, Milka, Noah. 5 tzaddikis daughters of Tzlafchad. 40 years, they're bachelors. They can't find the shidduch. Come the tribes and complain, and God says, okay, you can't marry anyone else but your relatives, but your tribe. And right away the Torah says they found their shidduchim. So people say that when a person feels like they can marry anyone, say has all the options, and this guy's nose is a little bit too long, and this guy, I don't like his beard. So I have all the options in the world.
I heard differently though. I heard that they were tzaddikas because they didn't marry with
their... We quoted that medrash last week, right? That way last week we quoted that medrash. So this is another this isn't the medrash. This is a vort that people say. And maybe there's some truth to it. I think that sometimes people really don't get married because they allow themselves to be too picky. Sometimes. That doesn't mean that it's our responsibility to tell every person that we know that's been dating for 30 years that they're too picky. That's very hurtful. People do that a lot, unfortunately. Yeah. What?
I'm sorry, it happens a lot.
That people say that?
No, that people are picky.
That people are too picky. Both things happen. It happens that people are too picky, and it also happens that any person that doesn't get married by the time they're 30 has people telling him once a week that he should stop being so picky. People who have no business telling him what to do with his life. The book of Bamidbar really ends with their marriage, and these are the mitzvahs that God gave us. It's interesting to note that the Torah begins with marriage, Adam and Chava, and the Torah ends really Bamidbar with marriage, and Sefer Dvarim is a Sefer unto itself, which ends with its own chesed, the burial of Moshe Rabbeinu. Tov, Bezrat Hashem, now we'll go over to Shmuel.